Hi, I'm David Reardon, and welcome to the Integral Life Film Review Series. Sitting across the aisle from me in virtual space is best-selling author, philosopher, and the co-founder of Integral Life, Ken Wilber. Welcome, Ken.
Hey, Dave. How you doing, buddy?
We are really excited because today we are headed into the world of the Na'vi to review the blockbuster hit Avatar. We have intentionally waited to review this film until all the hoopla had died down from the epic box office numbers that Avatar posted on its way to becoming the most successful film of all time. To date, the theatrical numbers worldwide are over $2 billion.
It's amazing.
More than half of that is in foreign earnings. So what that has revealed about the popularity of this film is that it is truly a global event. It was just as hard to get a ticket in China as it was in the United States. We also wanted to let some of the cultural critiques of Avatar emerge a little more fully before we looked at Cameron's story from an integral viewpoint. This film has definitely become a flashpoint in the culture war between its diehard supporters and its harsh critics. There is much to talk about as we explore the themes in this film, but let me say right up front that for me, in terms of filmmaking, Avatar represents a momentous leap forward in digital production techniques. With its extensive use of 3D imagery, new motion capture technology, and its beautiful digital environments. At its alien best, the world of Pandora and the Na'vi are simply breathtaking to behold. And we want to talk more about these aspects of the film later in the review, but Ken, let's just jump to the obvious place we want to start. What do you see in this film from an integral perspective?
Let me give a little background here, because the movie is really working with worldviews, with value systems, and and a clash of two dominant value structures. Not many people know that developmentalists have done enormous amount of research on what worldviews are, how they develop, what their structures are. One of the great pioneers in developmental worldviews was Gene Gebser, who found that humankind, both phylogenetically and ontogenetically, proceeds from archaic to magic, to mythic, to rational, to pluralistic, to integral worldviews. The archaic is the transition from ape to human. And in tribal magic, it's clans and tribes up to about 30 to 40 people, which is the ecological carrying capacity of foraging, hunting and gathering. It's about 40 people. They've not yet invented the wheel. They are indissociated from nature. So nature is alive. There's a spirit god or goddess for wind, fire, volcanoes, rivers, etc. But it is a limited type of holism. As Claire Graves pointed out, there is, quote, a name for every bend in the river, but no name for the river. A truth is maintained by ancestors, and ancestor worship is central. And these are all Na'vi characteristics we notice. Including not developing the wheel and ancestor worship and nature alive, and so on. The mythic traditional values brought together isolated tribes into larger societies and beginning nations by a single mythic deity, as the 12 tribes of Israel were united under Yahweh. Clans are blood kinship related. If you're not blood related, you're not part of the clan. Myth allows non-blood relatives to be related as a son or daughter of the mythic god or goddess. Interest shifts to universal truth, which is usually felt to be contained in one book, the Bible, the Quran, etc., that was delivered by one human divine person, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, etc. If you believe the mythic truth, you belong. If not, you're an infidel who can and often should be killed. But we can't say that mythic is more complex structure than magic. And it's absolutistic. Like the fundamentalists who come from this worldview, its truth is absolutely and literally true with no exceptions. Moses really did part the Red Sea, locusts really did rain on Egypt, and so on. Then we move to modern reason. Here, truth is multiplistic. There are many different kinds of truth claims. But the best way is discovered by science, by reason and evidence and experiment, not revelation and inspiration and myth. The major example here, of course, is the Western Enlightenment. But because myth is overthrown, you don't have to be a believer to be treated equally. All human beings, regardless of race, color, sex, creed, tribe, or deity, are to be treated fairly. This is in the Bill of Rights. For example, we find the end of slavery. Every societal type, including tribal magic, had some form of slavery until modern reason, which abolished it. In about a 100-year period, 1770 to 1870, slavery was abolished from every modern industrial nation on Earth. The downside, because this is the worldview of the Earthlings in Avatar, the downside is that there is too much emphasis on science and matter to produce scientific materialism, very reductionistic worldview. Too much emphasis on business and its materialistic profit motive, and the environmental destruction that too much industrial business can bring. At the same time, however, there is the emergence, for the first time in history, of the environmental and ecological sciences, the study of the Earth as a whole. Earlier societies lacked this complex notion because, again, they had a name for every bend in the river, but no name for the river as a whole. But in the modern era, sciences of the river as a whole emerged, even as they took a back seat to scientific materialism and reductionism. And the next more complex worldview is postmodern multiculturalism, which is very recent, about 30 years or so. As cognition becomes even more complex, it realizes that there isn't just one truth for all people, but that different cultures produce legitimately different truths and views of reality. In the place of modernity's one big picture, postmodernity maintains multiple pictures for multiple cultures and warns us against exclusion or ranking or oppressing different cultures merely because they are different. All truth is relative, pluralistic, and egalitarian. Now, all of these initial worldviews, up to and including pluralistic postmodernism, all believe that their truth is the only real truth there is. So there are constant culture wars in today's world, with traditional fundamentalists versus modern science versus postmodern pluralism. But then there occurs what Claire Graves calls, quote, a momentous leap of meaning. And that's the emergence of the integral worldview. And this sees that there is a legitimate place for all of these earlier worldviews. They all have a right to exist. And for the people at each of those stages, they legitimately represent truth and goodness and beauty. They are all chapters in one great universe story. This is a super holistic level which draws together important insights from all previous levels and accords each a rightful place in the universe story. Now, Avatar is a story told from the postmodern pluralistic level about how it sees a clash between modern and tribal values. Jake and Grace are from modern scientific culture, and the Na'vi are pre-modern tribal culture. Now, the postmodern level, like all previous developmental levels, especially loathes the level right before it, because that is the level it is trying to grow beyond and transcend. So the movie, coming from a postmodern level, believes that the cause of all evil in the world is due to the modern scientific level. It sees none of the positives of modernity, only the negatives. It is exploitative, colonializing, and oppressive. As Jake put it, all it has are light beer and blue jeans. There's nothing about the abolition of slavery, the rise of feminism, the Bill of Rights, ecology, modern science and physics, the rise of modern medicine, and the adding of a stunning three decades to average lifespan, and so on. Just light beer and blue jeans. And oppressive militaristic tendencies and this militaristic approaches shown in the movie. That's it for modernity. So while the postmodern structure is busy denigrating the modern structure, it simultaneously elevates the pre-modern. It is caught in the myth of the noble savage, or seeing tribal magic as a primal Eden. This is called the pre-post fallacy. The postmodern and the pre-modern are equated and confused simply because they are both non-modern. So the postmodern structure reads highly developed postmodern truths into the pre-modern era and ends up elevating it all out of proportion. Hence the noble savage versus an evil, nasty modernity. And once you've done that, you're basically off and running with Dances with Wolves, which is the essential plot that this movie is basically following. It's a white guy coming from evil, modern, militaristic, oppressive society, discovers noble savages and noble Eden culture, and eventually becomes one of the natives, thus finding real truth and nature-bound meaning, not beer, light, and blue jeans. But Avatar has a happier postmodern ending than Dances with Wolves because the magic tribes actually win the war.
Or they win the battle.
They win the battle.
Yeah, because I want to go to that, because there's actually a correlation in the Native American story in the Americas, particularly around the battle with Custer and what that and what that represented, and then what happened after that.
Right.
I want to get to it, but go ahead.
Yeah, and these are difficult to interpret because it's tending to show one structure at its worst and one structure at its best, and so it's quite confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, modernity in this pre-post confusion absolutely hates tribes. So the sergeant calls them savages. They're fly-bitten savages that live in trees. And Jake, before he turns, calls it tree-hugger crap. And one of the modern Earth guys says, killing is bad, but poor quarterly statements are worse. And that's supposed to be the essential kind of drive of modernity. So the movie is essentially the way that the postmodern worldview views the clash between modernity and pre-modernity, and the very common views and mistakes that are made when the postmodern structure does that. But it represents a kind of nostalgia that people in the modern and postmodern era feel, because what they've actually done is to sever themselves from these earlier levels. And that's not supposed to happen. Every stage in a healthy fashion is supposed to transcend and include its predecessor. But modernity too often transcended and excluded earth-oriented, body-oriented tribal truths. And the movie is strong on those, especially human nature bonding. Naitenyi says, quote, there is a network of energy connecting all living things.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake says, my people killed their mother, that is to say this network, Gaia. There is no green there, which could be a kind of a capsule statement of the global climate crisis right now. And so one of the things that comes from Earth and comes from nature is, of course, élan vital and a sense of a true aliveness and connected meaning. And that's what the modern world too often lost track of. And so it didn't just differentiate the spheres of the good, the true, and the beautiful, or self and culture and nature. It dissociated them and actually ended up, in many cases, denying the world of nature altogether and became entirely too abstract and too, let's say, business-oriented and not playfully oriented enough to these really primal, fundamental, originating stages of development. And these stages are still part of what we are, but we have to enliven them. We have to get in touch with them. We have to actually practice being in touch with a body-bound worldview. And that's what is so beautifully done in this movie, is it takes just the very, very best of the tribal value structure and body earth orientation and paints a picture of its very, very best moments. Even if they're eulogized, it still is sort of in the ballpark. It enlivens people to watch it. And then it also allows them to have a villain, which is anything having to do with modernity and business, military, and so on. And we can certainly see the evil components in all of those. but it allows that playing out. And while it's doing that, it's allowing people to really get in touch with being in touch with the earth. There's, you know, particularly the bond, the close bond that's made between the flying horses mm-hmm. and their riders through the hair ponytail linkage, mm-hmm. which is an actual physical bonding with nature. And then, of course, it's still the case that man is controlling nature, but there's also a felt meaning. There's an aliveness to it. There's a mutuality on both sides of this. The flying horse chooses you and you choose it. And I think it's that aliveness from an earlier stage of development that the modern world has just tended to neglect and even repress that makes the movie so endearing. It's the same thing, really, that made Dances with Wolves such an astonishingly huge hit.
Right.
Same problems with it, same essential clashes, same demonizing of everything modern and eulogizing of everything pre-modern, and then we're off and running with a noble savage and a vicious evil modernity. And we see the same thing here, except, you know, it's enormously more technologically sophisticated, and so you can start to suggest what those real moments of nature connection are like. And everything in nature becomes magical and alive and inviting and, you know, Edenic. And I think that's one of the things that is just such an enormous appeal for moviegoers across the board, is it actually, while they're sitting there in the theater, is helping to awaken these earlier levels of awareness in themselves
mm-hmm.
and give them a taste of what that's like. And it's very successful from that angle.
That's the promise of the movie that I got when I went back and watched it a second and third and fourth time. Of course, I went and saw it in the movie theater in 3D just to
right.
get that experience. And that was something, because I'm not a big fan of 3D. And
yeah.
I kind of came away going, okay, still not quite a fan. I think it's kind of a little distracting, but it definitely created a real experience in the movie that was very different watching it on DVD.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing to me, Ken, was that I have this initial first reaction of saying, well, here it is. What we're saying and claiming from Integral, that we can see these things, then they should be showing up in the culture. Well, here it is.
Right.
Here's an example, right? But as I went back and looked at it, one of the questions that I started to play with just from an art standpoint and from a point of creativity is that certainly the analogy with Dances of Wolves I can see. I mean, I can see that there's very similar structures. There's even the character that plays the head warrior even looks like the main warrior in Dances with Wolves. Certainly we can look at the developmental clues that you've been talking about and Western psychology has offered us, and it continues to develop. But the purpose of future story, particularly when you go off-world, when you go to another place as opposed to Earth,
right.
when we look at Dances with Wolves, we actually are seeing a romanticized version of a history that is actually, we know,
right.
because it actually happened. Right that way, right?
Right?
So we can go back and say, all right, well, this actually did happen. I mean, natives did have some victories against this much larger military power, but they basically lost the war. And
right.
at the end of Dances with Wolves, this is the sadness that we feel on that
right.
film, because we know this is coming.
Right.
We know that, as he says, there are just too many of them. You lost 10 warriors. They may have even lost 20, but they can replace them with 200. And you're just going to get worn down and you're not going to be able to find anything to eat and so on. And we know this is what happened, that these amazing warriors that were, you know, for a while sort of held their own, basically starved to death and then came into the reservations. And, you know, it was an attrition of numbers. And so we know that history is there. And so we can apply those developmental observations to all that. But here we go into a future story, which takes place on a different world. And certainly we see other examples of this within filmmaking culture. I mean, the obvious ones are Star Wars and Star Trek, where humans are now venturing out and coming across intelligent civilizations. And oftentimes the theme is that, gee, they sort of developed like us here on Earth,
right.
but then they kind of made a turn that was different. So Star Trek played with this a lot because they had more time on the television show to actually do those kinds of things. So they would find somebody that had sort of taken on the Nazi thing, but they'd done some kind of weird twist on it so that
right.
it was a little more benevolent, if that's possible, right? So,
right.
And so we would say, well, yeah, with few different things that would happen, we know in our own lives that our lives take a particular turn in a journey, whereas they would have been very different had we turned left versus right, right?
Right.
So when I started to look through those eyes and I said, you know, one of the challenges in a film, and this film was long anyway, is that when you're establishing the mythology of Pandora and who we are and who they are and all the rest of it, there just wasn't time in terms of the Na'vi to really see who they were, really.
Right.
For instance, we never saw anything that challenged them. We don't see what's up for them from an evolution standpoint, right? So
right.
So that we say, well, did Cameron sort of do what a lot of other people have done and present sort of a steady state environment that never changes? That is a romanticized view. The second thing was little things about the way they did things. One thing that you've mentioned is that the joining, that's available to all of the members of the tribe. That's a different move for me than saying we let the shaman do that. And then the
right.
shaman come back and tell us after 4 days of fasting what God out there wants us to do, as
right.
opposed to this coupling, right, where you actually, and this is, you know, our language, can take the perspective. When you can take the perspective or feel the perspective of joined with this flying creature or this horse, or even when Jake goes to the Tree of Souls and kind of, you know, does a hookup, and then she said it doesn't kind of work that way.
Right.
You can't be asking for favors and so on and so on. We actually see that that experience is actually available to anyone within the group.
Well, see, that's exactly the point. In the pre-post fallacy, the pluralistic structure would never allow itself to eulogize the tribal structure the way it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
So it will read, as I said, several postmodern characteristics, especially egalitarianism,
mm-hmm.
into the tribal structure and present it as if that were actually the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it really believes that it was, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what I would expect from a pre-post fallacy. There is no way that the green pluralistic structure would eulogize a tribal structure that had the types of ranking systems and inequalities that tribal structures had.
Mm-hmm.
They just wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only by a real careful selection of some of the things that jump out at the pluralistic structure as being so admirable, at least through their interpretation, of tribal structures. And one of the biggest is its relation to nature.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's been quite a change, really, in our understanding of most indigenous tribes' relation to nature, which is not that they didn't spoil nature because they were using some sort of wisdom of restraint or anything. It's that the methods that they had could only do so much damage.
Mm-hmm.
Most tribes practice burn and slash types of foraging, agriculture.
Sure.
There's only so much damage you can do with a bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm.
You can't create an Auschwitz with a bow and arrow, but you can with modern technology. So it is some of those things about tribal structures that often misunderstood that make it out as this noble savage. And you say, well, what's noble about the noble savage? And it's every single pluralistic value you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they value. And that's how they present it.
Mm-hmm.
So then even though if they're trying to do it sort of anthropologically accurate, mm-hmm. then they will do things like not show it with anything resembling a wheel and not show it with really highly developed technology. But all of those things are put and are interpreted as some sort of course of wisdom that the tribes could do all of that stuff, but they're not, because they don't need it. They're
yeah.
above that. And that's the standard classic pre-post fallacy. So what I see really here is a pluralistic structure rereading the tribal structure and making it a noble savage. And it is. They don't, you know, of all the clans, they don't even have warfare among clans.
Well, yeah, I know. Isn't that different? Because even in Dances
yeah.
with Wolves, they basically said, look, at part of your initiation, Jake's initiation, would have been to go to the, in quotes, enemy camp, which would have been the other, right?
Right.
The other tribe.
Right.
And even if you didn't kill anybody, it was to count coup or steal horses or whatever. That was actually part of the initiation into the tribe's warrior system, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
They would actually do that. We see none of that here.
No.
Some notion of that they had come together at some time, and then, of course, he brings them together again, and they sort of come together when they need to, and then they kind of separate, but certainly no competition between them at all.
Right, and all of that just flies in the face of certainly of history.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that that's not reality according to any known tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So the question would be, well, did sort of future evolution actually devolve and take the best of the postmodern values,
mm-hmm,
and integrate them with the best of tribal values and come up with its own version of kind of an integrated, you know, postmodern world?
Right.
And there's nothing, you know, absolutely to say that something like that can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it is to say that from everything that we know about how history and evolution works, it won't, because there are too many structures that would have to be included, including the mythic structure, in order to have an integration between pluralistic and tribal.
Right.
But it is extremely common to a misreading that is epidemic in the postmodern world.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that modernity is the source of all evil, and pre-modern noble savage is when we were closest to reality.
Right.
And that is a primary moving myth of the modern and postmodern world.
Yeah, I want to jump more into that, but there was a couple of things I wanted to ask you, because there are obvious moments in the film that have to do with spirit.
Right.
And so the line that is the key line of the movie, "I see you," this is certainly not a god out there. This is not them going to an altar and her saying to Jake, put your, you know, bones and your magic offerings on the altar. This is actually that I see something, and I would say probably God in you, and that you see that in me, that it is more than obviously just visually seeing. So what did you make of that whole interchange about how they presented how God exists in the world, some description of how it lives in each one of us, or, you know, how did you see that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't very consistent. Because it's both available to sort of every individual, and yet it's available only through the ancestors and the tree of voices and can only be interpreted by the mother. And that's very interesting. That's one of the relics of a hierarchical system that pluralism would usually throw out. And it wouldn't say only the mother can interpret the voices of the ancestors. You all are equal interpreters of spirit. Nobody is higher than you or anything like that. But because they're sort of trying to also work in the fact that these are sort of matriarchal societies, these great noble societies were allegedly matriarchal, then of course it would be interpreted by the mother. But you can say, it's certainly legitimate interpretation to say, well, I see you means I am seeing spirit in you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also equally valid to say, I mean, one of the primary sort of dysfunctions of the pluralistic self is an extremely high degree of narcissism. Truth is true for me. I do my thing. You do your thing. My truth is true for me. It can't be challenged, and so on. And the scales, the narcissistic rating of people at the pluralistic stage is higher than any other. And so what everybody wants is to be seen. That's the standard complaint of the postmodern era, is I was never seen, I'm not seen, you don't see me, my father didn't see me, my mother didn't see me, my boyfriend doesn't see me.
Mm-hmm.
And all it wants is to be seen. That is, it wants to be central to attention. And that's one of the main drives of that stage. And so, of course, it would sop over into one of the main drives of the tribal stage. Whereas that was one of the least drives of the tribal stage. Being an individual was almost meaningless in tribal structures. There was tribal truth and truth of ancestors, but individual truth, individuals hadn't really differentiated. The concept of an individual was simply unknown. So it's not something that we would find historically. It is, however, something that the pluralistic structure would want to see in its Eden. Because its primary desire right now is, I want to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that actually didn't surprise me very much. And the fact it did contradict the rest of the other side of the spirituality story here, which was that Iwo was accessible through the Tree of Voices,
right,
and interpreted by the mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of kind of a pastiche of, you know, different value structures. It's some are actual tribal value structures, mm-hmm, and some are hidden postmodern structures, values, sort of, you know, slipped in to this Eden.
Right.
And so it's not a coherent picture. None of the actual sort of value structures about Pandora are really a coherent story.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of a little bit, you know, pre-modern, a little bit post-modern, and the sort of mixtures in between. So, but it definitely, the one thing it did clearly do, aside from those inconsistencies, is it paints a picture of an Eden in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And however, you know, sort of misinterpreted that really is of the original tribal structures, it's certainly still a level and a degree of awareness, and there's a bioenergy in every sentient being, and certainly in every human being. And getting in touch with that is, you know, is one of the main endeavors of an enormous number of therapeutic maneuvers. Enormous number of theories have realized that the modern man is out of touch with his body and his nature.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to, you know, in that sense, get back to nature, get back in touch with our bodies.
Right.
And I think this film paints as extraordinarily inviting a picture of back to nature as any film has ever done. There is, objectively speaking and truthfully, a bioenergy that, you know, connects all living beings.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things in recent research is that there is science and there is medicine working with this energy, working with this bioenergy.
Mm-hmm.
And working with ways that we see interruptions in this biofield to cause physical illness, and ways that restoring the biofield through hands-on techniques or through really sophisticated machines that create these biofields, but restoring them can have a very positive effect on physical illness. And that's just been a huge explosion of interest in that field in the last decade or so.
Yeah.
And so presenting this particular tribe as living in touch with that bioenergy, you know, all the time, is not that crazy. I think it's certainly what resonates with people in the audience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we all said, there was a certain reaction in the culture that there was, they called it the Avatar Depression. The people were actually depressed for days after seeing the movie, and you go,
right,
well, what is that about? And you go,
right,
it was so beautiful, and I,
exactly,
so wanted to be there,
exactly,
that I then look at our world, and I just see it as flatland, to use one of your words.
Yeah, exactly.
And just not vibrant and alive. But you mentioned something about the disconnect from the body, and this is the other main theme for me that I think is curious, and it goes right up to the ending, and we'll get there in a minute, but as opposed to Dances with Wolves, where we actually see the white man go native, right?
Right.
And in a certain sense, that we see him ride out,
right,
we see him take on the beads and the clothes, we see him,
right,
smoke the pipe, fall in love with the beautiful, even though she is a white captive,
right,
you know, all that, right? In this movie, though, what Cameron presents is something that you and I have talked about in Singularity. I mean, in terms of where human beings are going and the,
right,
capabilities that may be available even in the next 10 to 20 years of a human 2.0, that would,
right,
be some. So, right. So you know where I'm going with this. The avatar itself is what, for me, is an interesting element that separates it from a movie like Dances with Wolves, because,
yes,
we see him try on everything, but Jakeman is moving into the DNA, even though his avatar, I think they say at the beginning, is a combination of,
yes, avatar,
human,
are,
right?
Half,
yeah.
Yeah, half human, yeah, DNA and half.
So this is
Pandora.
Interesting, because now, into speaking of perspective taking, right, we're no longer saying, oh, you know, Kevin Costner just liked this idea of something. Jake is actually having an experience within half of his biology is new,
yeah,
right? I mean, with this creature now that has, you know, amazing abilities, and it's,
right,
big, and it's strong, as the, I think, as the bad guy said, you know, they have naturally occurring some kind of fibers that make them very tough to kill. And
exactly,
they bounce off trees and they can fly,
right,
through the air, and they don't,
right,
they just kind of roll over and don't get hurt.
Right.
This is all very attractive, but what I see in that, and the questions that it is now going to raise, because the ending of the way the ending of the film is that Jake's conversion, as opposed to the Costner character's conversion in Dances with Wolves has another element to it, in a certain sense that we actually even, he loves this idea that he can walk again. We certainly understand that motivation, and he's running already and seems really coordinated, and they get all that with the Marine. But he's actually living in the biology. When he is in the avatar, he's actually there.
Right.
And that to a certain extent, we can make an argument that, particularly in a lot of future movies, like the new series V is doing this with this notion that the lizards have taken on human biology, and the biology is actually changing them.
Right.
And they're actually experiencing what it is like on a cellular level to emote human anything, right?
Right.
And it's actually part of the plot, you know, or
right.
Some of these people are actually changing. So we actually see the same thing in him.
Right.
And at the end now, with him making, we think, a permanent transference to a body, which they never say whether that body at the end, you know, when we see the ceremony where they do the transfer, right?
Right.
I'm assuming, because nobody says anything differently, that that is his avatar. It's not some new body that they grew for him like the Body Snatchers or something.
Right.
We've never seen that. The tribe doesn't do that unless we're going to see that in the next movie, that
right.
they actually can create bodies for people to move into. I don't think they had that technology. So we're
right.
assuming that's his avatar. So even though he is making a permanent switch, right? I mean, he's now no longer going to be sitting in the coffin interface, right, where
right.
he's still human, but he can now control. He actually is going to become whatever the avatar is.
Right.
And it's a mixture of both human
right.
and Navi. And it has all of his memories, all of his cultural biases. Everything that's human is coming with him.
Right.
So the question of where this character is going and what is going to be the effect of this little drop in the Navi pool.
Right.
Who actually have an evolutionary, potentially, an evolutionary variance, right?
Right.
That could go a lot of different ways. What did you think of all that? Because I thought that was, I mean, certainly it was fun to think about, oh, I could project myself into this great body and go run around the world and go do all these things. We love this about virtual worlds, right?
Yeah, because it's a future world fantasy, then you're allowed to project your own sort of utopian ideals
mm-hmm.
into it. And it does seem to be what this is doing. It is saying that the Na'vi is better than the Earthling,
mm-hmm.
that it has a lot of values that are just better. And as far as what's actually said, there's nothing good on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And everything good is with the Na'vi. But it's certainly allowed, you're allowed to say what you think, you know, utopia would be like. And this is very close, apparently, to Cameron's. But it's also, it's essentially the same, quote, new paradigm that we've been hearing from boomers for 20 or 30 years.
Mm.
It's nature-based, and it's organic. It's not mechanistic. It's holistic. It's not analytic. It's eco-centered, not ego-centered. We've heard this story for 20 or 30 years. It is every baby boomer's idea of utopia, and it has been. And it has all of the, you know, confusions and fallacies and mixed up notions present in it, along with about half of it being some very important truths and some very important recent discoveries and so on that are coming about. And but those are mixed up. It's a pre-trans, pre-post fallacy, where a whole lot of pre-rational elements are elevated to trans-rational, post-rational reality and made part of utopia, just out of a lack of understanding. But there's really nothing essentially new in that version of utopia. It's the same new age that the new paradigm thinkers have been giving us, like I say, for 20 or 30 years, with, of course, you know, individual wrinkles. But in this case, it is interesting that it's a technology that allows humanity to jump into the body of the Na'vi and to cellularly become mixed with it, to actually become a part of it. And so that is, you're right, that's a little drop in the gene pool
right.
of these. Apparently, you know, the population is still at the point where there's just a bunch of separate clans. They haven't even risen to a one nation status. So they're still fairly low on a social level of holism. And they were brought together, as happens at the mythic level, by Toruk, Makto, a non-human deity,
right.
which is how every series of clans and tribes are brought together into early nations in human history is by the introduction of a non-human deity or non-Navi deity. And so that was a mythic element in an otherwise magic story. And then they were all brought together with a lot greater ease than what actually happened in reality. But apparently there are all these clans off doing their own thing. But in this one clan, and whether the Na'vi represents all of the clans or just this one, I'm not exactly clear. But in this one clan, now all of a sudden there's a drop of human DNA that has gone into it. And, you know, apparently would have some sort of ripple effects. Now, given the way that the movie so far has defined humanity, the effects could only be the creation of half-evil creatures.
Mm.
So, you know, the future stories could tell about, I mean, you're going to have this, it's like Spock, you know, the way he sees it. It's half-human, which is horrible, and half-Vulcan, which is fantastic.
Right, but I think that that's probably also the promise. I certainly understand what you're saying, is that because it's an open book at this point, I mean, in a certain sense, the eye's open. We sense that he's now fully entered, and that's it. I mean, and so what do we think is going to happen? Well, what have we seen? I mean, this is really goes to the whole thing that if we look at the whole Battle of Bighorn and Custer, you could say, all right, so the maniac that was, you know, running, you know, the guy that couldn't be killed, which is one of Cameron's trademarks that I love about bad guys. If you're going to set a bad guy up, don't kill him easily.
Right.
Right. This guy just kept going and going and going and going.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's so satisfying in the end. You want his death to be slow. You want Cameron, he did it in Terminator. He did it in The Abyss. I mean, he knows he had to tweak us at the end, particularly when he's set up. And that's, you know, it's good storytelling. But anyway, you know, if we really believe that the march of the humans onto that shuttle is the end of the story, even if we look at our own history, my guess is that one way you could go with this is he more than likely is going to say what Costner says before he takes off at the end of Dances with Wolves. And he said, look, you have to understand something about these people. They will never give up.
Right.
Right. They'll be back. I mean, you think this was bad? They'll come back, you know, 30, 40, 50 times stronger.
Right.
Because now they know that you have some capability and that, of course, the planet seems to as well.
Right.
So they'll just up the ante and they can lose, you know, they can lose a lot more people than you. This was also the other important detail in the movie. Remember when they were massing and the clans were coming together and we cut back to the control room and the lead military guy looks at the scope and he makes a determination. And what is it? And I was really interested in the numbers because this was going to be whether this is going to be the Native American story of eventually attrition is going to end this, right?
Right.
They're just more, right? So he says, what does he say? He says, wow, there's like 2,000 of them now, where there were just a few hundred a couple of days ago. And in another week, this is why we're going to preempt a strike. If you go like millions, then you have a different story. But if you say 20,000, which is what he said,
right,
then you're saying now what you're setting up is there aren't very many of them, really.
Right.
And that ultimately, if Earth really wants this very valuable thing that's there, they're just going to come back with, and I don't care how many flying creatures you have, you know, they'll just bring massive firepower, never put people in harm's way again and just take you out from space. I mean, right, they're going to do that. So Jake is more than likely, my guess is going to warn of that. I mean, he would. That would be part of his role. So this next movie, how it deals with, so are they coming back? And if they are coming back now, what do we do? What are we doing, right, about all that? That to me is, although I think that certainly you can make the argument that you made, it's also the potential promise that the story Cameron could take that in a different direction and actually bring some of the more positive aspects of human being with this obvious, you know, Na'vi, and do something interesting.
There's one possibly positive, because it doesn't really identify sides, but at the very beginning of the movie, Jake makes some offhand comment about, well, back on Earth, they're still fighting for freedom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So apparently on Earth, much as Earth today, there are still wars that are being fought in the name of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we all know that just sociologically what one culture calls freedom, another culture calls oppression. So the fact that, I mean, every terrorist on the planet says they're a freedom fighter.
Of course.
And every oppressor on the planet says they're fighting for freedom. So this freedom is apparently a good thing. But it does say that the Earth is not just a monoculture. There's still freedom wars going on. And so presumably there are good guys and bad guys in that, which means presumably there are some good elements in humanity other than these imperialistic, colonizing, militaristic brutes, which is how they're presented. So there's a direction to go with that as well. I mean, we sort of have to remember in terms of reality, is that in reality, there's actually a force of eros. That evolution is driven by increasing unifications. And that is a main drive behind evolution itself. I mean, you have the Big Bang, and you've got a bunch of quarks wandering around, and that's it. And then all of a sudden, several quarks in a vicinity of each other bind together and form a neutron. And a new boundary is formed, a bigger particle, more unity is formed, and then neutrons and protons and electrons are running around, and one day several of those in the same vicinity come together to form a molecule. They form helium. And then later on, more and more and more compounds are formed. And then those start to come together into huge poly chains. And at some point, a very complex group of these polymolecular chains come together to actually form a living structure. They come together to form a virus or a bacteria. And these bacteria come together to form, you know, more compound plants and animals, and those form more compound and so on. The driving force of evolution is eros. It's an integrating drive. And that's why at the leading edge, I should say, of evolution, human evolution, each leading edge stage, going all the way back to magic, is more integrated, has more unifying capacity than its predecessor. And so magic tribes could bring together more than gorillas. Mythic nations brought together hundreds of tribes into one unity. And then modern nations have unified ethnic boundaries enormously. And every unfolding of evolution is more and more unified. So what you want to see here right now, this movie, is not in the least interested in integrating humans and Na'vi. But what we see with Jake is the first potential integration of humans and Na'vi.
Yeah.
And so there's a way out for this movie to actually take an integral turn and to identify the positive things that are human and the positive things that are Na'vi, and start to show how those are. And that could turn up being as sort of as powerful a meta myth for these times as The Matrix was.
Right.
The Matrix drew on, you know, one of modernity's also sort of widespread myths itself, that we're really in touch with illusions and unrealities, and we're really out of touch. We have false consciousness, and we're out of touch with what's real. And The Matrix plays on that, you know, beautifully, and gives us a way of looking at that. Well, this could be, you know, a trilogy about what humanity needs to reintegrate to have truly integral levels. And it does need to reintegrate its relationship with nature and its relationship with the body. And so Jake, in a weird sense, could be a forerunner to that type of integration. And it could go in that direction and be very consistent with what it said so far.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if he was doing Transcend and Include?
Well, that would be wild.
Right, where he would say, look, guys, here it is, right? Here's all these levels of development. They have positive aspects to all of them. I can show them in you. I can see them in me and whatever.
Exactly.
And there are also pathologies to each one. Those are the ones we want to heal. So here's the strategy. This is what I wanted to say, right? This is my fantasy.
Yeah.
Here's the strategy. They're going to come back, right? But they're not going to know what they're walking into, because we will have looked at this, whatever that strategy is, from a later level of development, which
right.
I am not at, but I can call it in you and in me. And so that's my fantasy about where he left the door open. And we saw this in the first Star Wars and Star Trek to a certain extent, is that the mythology, you have more time to explain the mythology as you move on, right?
Right.
The world that you've created. And in the first one, you're just skimming over the surface because you're just trying to make a very taut, entertaining movie, which I thought he did. And Cameron's is an expert at action adventure. I mean, we've seen this in the Terminator series, and we've seen it not The Abyss. I mean, in a lot of his work, he's, you know, people say, well, that, you know, the dialogue is wooden. I'm going, yeah, this is not a feel-good, romantic story, even though there were elements of that. This is an action-adventure movie, and Cameron's really good at getting on with it, right? I mean,
right. Just,
you know, giving you the basics. You know, if he'd stopped to deal with something, the movie would have been 4.5 hours, right, by
right.
the time you were done. So
right.
he will have more opportunity, not only in the movies, but whatever other products get built, too, because they may build a virtual world out of this. They may
right.
build games out of this. Who knows? There may be a TV series or something where you really can explore these things at depth. But that was the big thing missing for me, as much as I'd like to fantasize that the Integral View really could help Jake and actually be a really interesting, as you're saying, a new narrative that would be very important to this planet at this point with something as popular as Avatar is going to be. So
yeah, and you know, Jake doesn't have to be a genius
right.
to be a carrier of evolution, because
mm-hmm.
all he has to have is an extra perspective that the previous level doesn't have.
Right.
And by combining the perspective of human and the perspective of Na'vi, then he automatically has an emergent perspective, a higher perspective. He can see through both the eyes of a human and eyes of a Na'vi. And that is, by definition, a higher perspective. So he, by definition, is potentially carrying a higher level of evolution. And so that is something that is a very solid truth that you can base a mythology on. And, of course, then it can include the other things that you would want to see in your utopian post-postmodern future. And one of them certainly it continues to be the reintegration with nature. And, incidentally, that was the one item that George Lucas had in his future
mm-hmm.
series, which was the one item that you could find in the future there that you couldn't find in the present, was may the force be with you.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing. It was a unifying life force connecting all living things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing that we just lost when we lost the tribal, you know, connectivity.
Yeah.
And so that's been a problem for human beings from day one and would have to be part of our utopian view. It would have to be ecocentric. It would have to be centering on ecology and not mm-hmm. just humanity. This is an open door to how to do that. I think it's a really extraordinary story. It's really fun. And most of all, it's just so beautifully presented, and which is one of the other problems, incidentally, of modernity, is that one of the dignities of modernity is that it's what Weber called differentiating the value spheres. The spheres of truth and goodness and beauty were differentiated.
Mm-hmm.
Art and morals and science were differentiated so that science could pursue its own truths without the morals of the church intervening. And so therefore you got modern science. In the previous era, the mythic traditional era, the church was telling Galileo what he could or could not say was true. All of that stopped with modernity and the differentiation of the good, the true, and the beautiful, with each of them pursuing their own course of action. But the disaster of modernity is that these three spheres didn't just differentiate, they dissociated. And truth, meaning cognitive scientific truth, colonized the other two, oppressed them, got rid of beauty and got rid of morals. And so that we really had nothing but scientific materialism. And science is giving us the only truth and the only goodness and the only beauty. And so it left modernity a peculiarly ugly culture.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty just actually gets handed over, if anywhere, to the devil. Beauty becomes something that you have to be wary of. And if somebody's beautiful, they can't be smart, and on and on and on. Beauty just got almost erased from this culture. And one of the things that it's just immediately striking about the Na'vi is the beautiful environment that they live in, and all of which is sort of the behind-the-scenes story, but the disappearance and the reappearance of aesthetics is, I think, an important hidden theme of the film. And I think a lot of people go out of it depressed because of just the visual beauty that they lack.
I know.
Not even the meaning or any of that.
No,
just
I
the,
know.
Oh, it just, I could taste it. It was like living in a universe of chocolate. You know, it's just so wonderful.
The beauty that we can imagine with these new tools is just absolutely breathtaking. That part is, you just go, regardless of what I think of anything about the movie, or, you know, certainly I was entertained by it. Also, I think it's very interesting, like we've been talking about, and where it could go. I think it has some promise. And certainly it's a global event. So we have to see that this is a magnetizing force within the culture. So that's just interesting all by itself, of saying, why is this attracting so many people all over the world, right?
Right.
So, I mean, the worlds that you can create with these new technologies and the characters that you can imagine really do sort of move into our dreams in the best sort of way, and just inspire us to, as you say, to bring that whole element back into our lives. And
right.
for that, I'm appreciative of what Cameron did with this, for sure.
Yeah, me too, and did a beautiful job of it. It really is a psilocybin-lit Eden.
And it looked like a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
So when he jumps on the flying creature the first time, I'm going, whoa, that would be just amazing.
Exactly.
Right. To actually do that. Well, Ken, anything else?
No, I think this is great. They're really, really pushing the leading edge on these special effects and technology stuff.
Yes.
And of course, James Cameron had a large hand in it. So it just, congratulations for all those technological things. At the very, very least, brilliant.
Yeah, and from all the things we've been talking about, I think he's left the door open. That's the hopeful part of me,
right?
I can certainly go to you may do the same story.
Yeah.
Can we get above that?
Yeah.
But he's actually left the door open to do something else. And what's going to be really interesting to me, because, we watch him when he's been at the award shows and what he's said about it and so on. His intention that this was just going to be a movie and he would get on with the many projects that he also has in development. But now he's just said at least there'll be another one and probably another one after that.
Right.
And I just wonder, this is going to be the thing to really watch with him, is that as he has stepped into this material, just like Jake stepped into the Na'vi Avatar,
right.
How does that change you? When you get one like this,
right.
I mean, even though Terminator was successful and Aliens was successful, nothing close to this. I mean, it was sort of its own thing.
Yeah.
But this is a gift. And then, as we say with the unique self-teaching, where's the obligation? Will he feel an obligation to actually go above and beyond all the stories that have already been told and try something new? And certainly from an integral perspective, there would be things that could inform him about that.
Right.
So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, me too.
So thank you so much, Ken.
Okay, thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.